Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Republican frontrunner Donald Trump declined to participate in Thursday night's debate in Iowa. Meanwhile, the other Republican candidates for U.S. president commented on immigration and U.S. foreign policy. VOA's Jim Malone reports.
Yes, a Republican debate, minus Donald Trump. That's the big news. Trump held an event of his own just a few minutes away from the auditorium where the debate was held. He, of course, was upset with the moderators on Fox, which is broadcasting the debate. And Trump was doing a benefit for wounded warriors, so he was focused on that. The rivals, interestingly enough, talked about Trump initially. Some made a little bit of fun that he wasn't there, but they pretty much have left him alone after that. I don't know in the end if this is going to hurt Trump or help him or what.
VOA's Jim Malone reporting from Iowa. Authorities in Burundi have released two foreign journalists a day after they were arrested in the capital. VOA's Central Africa Service reports that British photographer Phil Moore and the Africa chief for the French daily Le Monde, Jean-Philippe Ramy, were released Friday. It says none of the two men's equipment was returned after they refused to disclose the passwords to their smartphones. Their media accreditations have also been revoked. Meanwhile, the human rights group Amnesty International says satellite images and witnesses point to possible mass graves in Burundi that appeared after security forces retaliated against rebel gunmen in Bujumbura. Look at our website at voanews.com, VOA News. The World Health Organization is convening an emergency meeting on the Zika virus Monday after the agency's director said the mosquito-borne virus is spreading at an alarming rate. The WHO warns millions of people could be impacted in the Americas, where already officials are using conventional and non-conventional techniques to slow and prevent the spread of the Zika virus, which has been linked to birth defects. In Honduras, fumigation trucks are attacking the virus at its source. UN officials say they're going ahead with talks to end the five-year-old Syrian civil war, starting Friday afternoon in Geneva after the opposition said it would not attend. A Syrian government delegation was due to arrive at the venue for the start of what UN organizers say will be indirect proximity talks that aim to lay the groundwork for negotiations to end the conflict. A UN spokeswoman told VOA the talks would begin with a meeting between UN officials and Syrian government representatives. VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez is reporting on the discussions.
The way the UN is doing this is they sent out invitations on Tuesday. It would not disclose who it had sent invitations to. We won't know till the very end. For now, the only ones that we have confirmed officially who will be attending will be members of a Syrian government delegation.
The Saudi-backed opposition group, the High Negotiations Council, said it will stay away after its demands for an end to airstrikes on civilians and a lifting on the siege in Syria have not been met. Representatives of the group, however, did not rule out joining later. The U.S. said Friday that its economy, the world's largest, barely advanced in the last 3 months of 2015. The Commerce Department said the anemic growth, just 0.7%, reflected weaker consumer spending, investment cutbacks by businesses, and slowing exports. The U.S. report, the first of three estimates of the country's economic growth for the October to December period, comes amid slowing economic advances throughout the world and stock market turmoil across the globe during January. U.S. and South Korean officials are privately saying they believe North Korea is preparing a missile launch within the next week. Japanese media reported that satellite images show North Korea seems to be setting up a long-range ballistic missile launch from the Tochanri site in western North Korea. News of a possible missile launch by Pyongyang follows a high-level meeting between the United States and China on sanctions against Kim Jong-un's government for conducting its fourth nuclear test on January 6. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Burundi's security minister says British photographer Phil Moore and Jean-Philippe Remy, the Africa chief for the French daily Le Monde, were arrested Thursday in the capital Bujumbura in the company of armed criminals. A colleague says the men have been questioned but not mistreated.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up.
Also, UN investigators in the Central African Republic uncover six more cases of alleged child abuse by peacekeeping troops. And researchers in Uganda say they have developed a new Ebola test kit that detects the virus in minutes.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Reuters reports authorities suspect an Egypt Air technician of planting a bomb on a Russian jetliner that exploded and crashed on October 31st near Sharm el-Sheikh. All 224 passengers and crew died. Unidentified sources also say that besides the technician, two airport security guards and a baggage handler are being held. Airline security sources deny any company employees are under suspicion. The Interior Ministry says no arrests have been made. An Egyptian government official says Egypt has lost $250 million in a month in tourism revenues since the tragedy occurred.
Police in Burundi say they have released two foreign journalists who were arrested yesterday. Burundi's security minister says British photographer Phil Moore and Jean-Philippe Remy, the Africa chief for the French daily Le Monde, were arrested in the capital Bujumbura. They were in the company of armed criminals. A colleague says the men have been questioned but not mistreated. VOA's Jill Craig has more from Nairobi.
Le Monde says Phil Moore and Jean-Philippe Remy were arrested while meeting with government opponents. It says both men were working for the paper and were doing their job by meeting with all parties involved in Burundi's political crisis. Julia Steers, a Nairobi-based freelance reporter working in Burundi, visited the two journalists Friday morning at Burundi's intelligence service headquarters, where they were being held. She said the French ambassador and a representative from the British consulate also visited the pair.
Well, we found out that they were both Phil and Jean-Philippe were arrested yesterday in the Nyakabiga neighborhood in Bujumbura in the capital, and they were held and questioned overnight. We were able to speak with them briefly and to bring them some food and some water, and they said that they were treated fairly. They were questioned extensively, but, you know, no evidence of mistreatment or torture.
However, Steers noted that the charges remain somewhat unclear.
This morning, the police spokesman here said that Phil was arrested in a company of armed men, which is something that Phil denied when we were able to speak with him. Again, we were only able to speak with him briefly, but he said he was just walking alone in this neighborhood around 4:30 yesterday afternoon and was approached by a police officer and arrested shortly thereafter. And then his colleague, Jean-Philippe, was arrested after that. So we're still not clear exactly what the charges are.
Ilya Gridneff, chairman of the Foreign Correspondents Association of East Africa, urged the Burundian authorities to release the journalists.
Both of them are consummate professionals, excellent journalists that have won awards and have worked in tougher parts of the world. And essentially, we've been pursuing all channels for their timely release.
That sentiment was echoed by Karina Tertsakian, senior researcher on Rwanda and Burundi for Human Rights Watch.
We're very worried about their situation. We believe the Burundian authorities should immediately release the two journalists unless there's a credible legal basis for detaining them, and the authorities should guarantee their safety. They should also ensure that they're not ill-treated in detention and that they can receive visits immediately from diplomatic representatives and lawyers.
Burundi's political crisis began last April when President Pierre Nkurunziza said he was running for a controversial third term. Human rights groups have denounced the government for cracking down on journalists and protesters in a bid to suppress political dissent. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Also, regarding the arrest and the release of the two foreign journalists, Burundi police reportedly have refused to return their equipment and have revoked their press credentials.
The UN Human Rights Chief says investigators have uncovered six more cases of alleged child abuse by peacekeepers in the Central African Republic. Zaid Rahad Al-Hussein says he is extremely alarmed at the ongoing reports of such allegations. The allegations say some children were raped by soldiers with the European Union operation, while others say they were paid to have sex with soldiers. The five girls and one boy were allegedly abused in 2014 at a camp for displaced persons near Bangui Airport. Last December, an independent panel criticized the UN's handling of previous sex abuse allegations in the CAR by soldiers from France, Equatorial Guinea, and Chad.
The World Health Organization has called a special meeting for Monday to decide whether the Zika virus poses a public health emergency. Yesterday, the WHO said Zika is spreading explosively in the Americas. It says as many as 4 million people may be infected by the end of this year. About 20 countries report cases of the mosquito-borne disease. Right now, the main concern is that the virus could cause birth defects, specifically a rare condition that causes babies to be born with abnormally small heads. The Zika virus was first discovered in Uganda in 1947 and is named after the forest near Kampala where it was found. However, Zika has never been a major health threat in Uganda. It's rare and mild there. Julius Lutwama is a virologist at the Uganda Virus Research Institute in Entebbe. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua about the history of Zika in Uganda.
The Zika virus was first identified in Zika Forest, and it was identified while scientists were studying diseases of monkeys in this forest. In particular, they were trying to find out whether there was yellow fever in this particular forest. They used to put out monkeys in cages, and these were put on platforms in trees, and the mosquitoes would bite these monkeys and investigate it to see whether the monkeys had got any infection. That is when this new virus was isolated. It was different from what they were looking for, and it was a new virus that had never been seen elsewhere. So it was given the name Zika virus.
Now, doctor, this was back in 1947, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So why, since then, has the Zika virus, in your opinion, not caused any major problems in Uganda?
There may be two or three possibilities. One of the possibilities is that it may be affecting people more often than we get to know. But because it is a mild infection, people don't take it importantly, and normally they don't go to seek medical assistance. The second reason is that while we have mosquitoes which may transmit the virus, these mosquitoes do not normally bite man during the day. So they bite at night, and they bite at night in the forest, and people are not there in the forest. The Aedes aegypti, which we have, which bites man during the day, does not like to bite man. We have this strain that is called Aedes aegypti formosus, which normally does not bite man. It prefers to bite other animals. The third reason, of course, is that we have several other flaviviruses, and the flaviviruses are known to confer some kind of cross-immunity. Because people have brought other flaviviral infections, then they may be protected from getting Zika virus. The fourth reason is that we have a strain of Zika virus which is not virulent, which is not causing big problems like the one which has now spread to South America, because it has undergone some kind of changes through some genetic changes.
So in your view, the Zika virus that people are very concerned about now, that's prominent in South America, for example, is a virus that probably has mutated from the version that was originally found in Uganda.
That is what I have read, that there is some change in the genome. There's a slight change in the genome, that it can multiply faster and better in humans than the original virus that was identified in Uganda.
As you know, the virus may cause birth defects in babies, and there's some speculation that this might be because of co-infections such as West Nile virus or chikungunya, that the mother, the pregnant woman, might have these co-infections along with Zika. Do you see any possibility of those co-infections making it worse?
Well, probably it could. I believe if they get these infections at the same time, there is that probability. If they get it at slightly different times, there may be some kind of protection of one to the other.
Doctor, do you think the Zika virus spread from Uganda to South America?
No, I don't think that is true. It is not true that the virus has traveled from Uganda, because the virus is not only in Uganda. While it was first identified in Uganda, it is spread over a wide area in sub-Saharan Africa and also in Asia. So there is the probability that it may have come from Asia, or it may have come from any other country in Africa where there is Zika virus. In 2007, there was an outbreak in Polynesia, and then I think it is from that area that it has moved toward Brazil.
Julius Lutwama is a virologist at the Uganda Virus Research Institute in Entebbe. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Authorities suspect an Egypt Air technician of planting a bomb on a Russian jetliner that exploded near Sharm el-Sheikh. UN investigators in the Central African Republic uncover six more cases of alleged child abuse by peacekeeping troops. And police in Burundi say they have released two foreign journalists arrested yesterday. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
In news on the European migrant and refugee crisis, the International Organization for Migration says deaths are increasing at an alarming rate. More than 244 have drowned in January while trying to reach Europe. The IOM says 26 Iraqi Kurds died last night when their boat sank in the Aegean Sea. The bodies of another six migrants were discovered on Libyan shores. More than 55,000 migrants have reached Europe this month. German police report more than 1,000 attacks on migrant hostels in the last 12 months. A hand grenade was tossed into a migrant hostel yesterday, but did not explode. And the EU has offered Turkey more than $3 billion to slow the flow of refugees and asylum seekers. The EU's border agency says the number of Syrian refugees has dropped in recent months as Iraqi migration increases. A new study released today says about 820,000 child deaths could be prevented annually by improving breastfeeding rates. The report also says approximately 20,000 breast cancer deaths among mothers could be prevented each year by increased breastfeeding. The Lancet breastfeeding series finds that a failure to breastfeed could lower a child's cognitive ability. The study also found that breastfeeding is more common in poor rather than rich countries. Dr. Nigel Rollins of the Department of Maternal, Newborn, Child, and Adolescent Health at the World Health Organization co-authored the series. He spoke to me about the findings.
The main findings from that are that there's been relatively little change in breastfeeding patterns over the past 20 years. There are different types of ways of measuring and talking about breastfeeding rates, one of the most important being exclusive breastfeeding in the first 6 months. And those rates have really increased marginally by about 11 percentage points over the past 15 to 20 years, up to where about 36, 37% of women globally exclusively breastfeed in the first 6 months, whereas WHO and all the UN organizations recommend that this is the ideal practice for all women. A second measure or indicator of breastfeeding practice is what we refer to as continued breastfeeding. And here we find that this varies a little bit by the income setting, that in low and middle income countries, up at 12 months, the numbers range in around about between 60 and 80%. It's not consistent across all low middle income countries as one, but that the rates are certainly a lot less in the high income countries.
Why do you think this is so?
And I think there's a mixture of reasons. And I think that you've got to say that probably what drives the breastfeeding practices in different countries may be a bit different. The reason why women probably in the low and middle income settings choose to breastfeed is one that they recognize the benefits much more immediately. They know what it means in terms of their child's health, the avoidance of diarrhea, avoiding pneumonia and surviving. And those really aren't issues that maybe women in the high-income countries think about. There's also the whole force of marketing of breast milk substitutes, which in the high-income countries has been a really dominant influence over the past 20 years. And that unquestionably erodes and undermines breastfeeding practices to the point that women in high-income settings, and it's not just even women, but it's actually men, society, communities in the high-income countries, they don't appreciate what actually breastfeeding can offer, not just to the child, but also to the mother's self.
Speaking of which, in Rwanda, for example, they have a very high breastfeeding rate, about 85 or 90%.
So I think one of the new things about these papers is that they refer to both the health benefits for the mothers as well as the infants. And most times you see reports, breastfeeding is really presented in terms of its benefits for children. For women, the longer the duration of breastfeeding and the cumulative period of breastfeeding over maybe several pregnancies in children decreases the risk of invasive breast cancer. So for every cumulative year of breastfeeding by a woman, it decreases her likelihood of invasive breast cancer by 6%. And there's also protection against ovarian cancer. It also confirmed what we've known before, that it really improves birth spacing. And that's a major benefit for women, actually. And it also actually benefits children. Wider birth spacing actually helps children to grow better.
You also mentioned the challenge of using breast milk substitutes, such as infant formulas. So how can that overcome these huge manufacturers of infant formulas?
There's two or three ways to address this. Clearly, there's a major role of government. There is a very effective set of agreements at the World Health Assembly that really provide a mechanism by which the marketing of breast milk substitutes can be effectively regulated. But these stipulations by the World Health Assembly, these need to be put into legislation in country. So in some countries, the code of marketing of breast milk substitutes is only a voluntary agreement. Other countries, it actually has firm legislation behind it. But even the firm legislation needs to have investment and money to actually monitor the code and any of the violations that we see all over the world. And then secondly, to actually impose meaningful penalties upon industry whenever they cross that line. But it's not just a role of government. It comes also back then to, well, certainly in the developed countries, you know, places like restaurants and supermarkets, actually making the environment a positive place for women who want to breastfeed. And these things complement one another. It's not just a matter of taking on the big stick. It's also a matter of creating a positive environment that really allows women to breastfeed well.
What are some other things that countries can do to invest in breastfeeding?
There's several things, and one of the important things is that what is needed maybe in one country is not necessarily the same elsewhere. There is a major change happening in Africa. It is moving from the archetypal poor image, and many, many of the countries are actually going through major economic transition. The benefits of breastfeeding, and this is something that we are understanding much, much more today, is that it profoundly influences the health trajectory of that infant for the rest of their lives. So things that are now emerging as major problems in all transitioning economies, obesity, the risk of non-communicable diseases, all of these things are positively protected by breastfeeding in those first years. And even more than that, you have the impact of breastfeeding on IQ. And early breastfeeding translates into better IQ, better cognition, better school attainment, better salary 30 years on. And that's important for both the individual family, the individual, but it's also important for the economy at national level.
That was Dr. Nigel Rollins of the Department of Maternal, Newborn, Child, and Adolescent Health at the World Health Organization. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C.
A new online database is finding medical quackery in Nigeria by helping people easily find out if their doctor has a license. Chris Stein has more from Lagos.
The website is called Dodgy Doctors, and it's a searchable database of Nigeria's licensed medical professionals. Temi Adeoye, strategist with Civic Technology Group, Code for Nigeria, which helped develop the database, says he got the idea from a similar tool in Kenya and realized it could help address the problem of fake doctors in Nigeria.
Quackery is a major pain in Nigeria. I have personally seen like clinics that you can be very sure this is not a licensed clinic.
Adoye says all people have to do is go to the news website Sahara Reporters, which is hosting Dodgy Doctors, and type in the name of their doctor to see if they're in the database of the Medical and Dental Council, Nigeria's regulatory body for licensed practitioners.
Why should I use this doctor? Because he's a doctor. Oh, no, because he's a licensed doctor. And how do I know that he's a licensed doctor? This tool tells me he's a licensed doctor.
Code for Nigeria also developed tools that help people locate the nearest hospital and determine the market price of pharmaceuticals. Henry Okwu Okenya, head of the Inspectorate for the Medical and Dental Council, called the issue of fake doctors massive. He said there are at least 30 open cases against alleged fake doctors nationwide. But he said the data Code for Nigeria is using is from 2006 and said the group should have waited for more up-to-date information before debuting the tool.
It's a lovely idea to have people know who's a doctor at the click of the phone. It's very laudable. But there needs to be an agreement, you know, reached with the Medical and Dental of Nigeria as to deploying this tool.
Adoye says the data used by Dodgy Doctors is the most recent available from the association. He says he plans to seek more recent data from the association if it is available and update the database accordingly. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to African News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of African News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting Monday, February 1st, we will begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, select the number 25 to leave us your answer. Get up, stand up.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, I get.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. UN investigators in the Central African Republic uncover six more cases of alleged child abuse by peacekeeping troops. And police in Burundi say they have released two foreign journalists who were arrested yesterday. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa. And later, Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party plans to hold a lavish $800,000 birthday party for President Robert Mugabe next month. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy, happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy, happy Friday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off with African football.
Kim, let's kick off in Rwanda, where we've reached the quarterfinal stage at the African Nations Championship football tournament. Our Voice of America listeners will remember this competition, also called CHAN, is for locally based players in Africa. So European-based stars like 2015 African Footballer of the Year, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang of Gabon, who's based in Germany, are not eligible. And speaking of Gabon, the Gabonese did not impress in Rwanda. They finished on the bottom of Group A, playing a scoreless draw against Morocco and losing to Ivory Coast and host Rwanda. The Rwandans are one of eight teams in action this weekend. Mark Ouma runs down the quarterfinal matchups for us.
Hosts Rwanda play the Democratic Republic of Congo in the Orange African Nations Championship quarterfinals at the Amahoro National Stadium in the capital Kigali tomorrow Saturday. Then Cameroon engage Ivory Coast at the Huye Stadium in Butare, some 140 kilometers south of Kigali. On Sunday, Tunisia encounter Mali at the Nyamirambo Stadium in Kigali before Zambia face Guinea at the Umganda Stadium in Gishenyi, some 160 kilometers northwest of Kigali.
Meanwhile, in Kigali, the Amavubi, or Wasps of Rwanda, will surely enjoy the support of a big partisan crowd when they play the 2009 CHAN champion, the Democratic Republic of Congo. So says our African football guru, David Legg.
We've got two potential humdingers coming up on Saturday. In the first match, and it will be played in Kigali at the Amahoro Stadium, and it's a stadium that's going to be full to its 30,000 capacity, whether it's sun or rain. It'll be Rwanda against the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, by a strange twist of fate, these sides met in a warm-up match of the tournament in Gisenyi, and the Rwandans won 1-0. And afterwards, the Rwandan coach, Johnny McKinstry, was saying, "The match was in Rwanda, but it felt like we were playing in the DR Congo." And the reason for that, Sonny, is Gisenyi is right on the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. And the Congolese flooded across the border to support their team. And they turned the Rwandan venue basically into a Congolese venue. Now, that will not happen in Kigali, I'm sure. We're going to see thousands and thousands of Rwandans at the Amahoro Stadium. And the Rwandans have got a bit of catching up to do now, because after two victories in Group A, they took a 4-1 drubbing from Morocco in the final match. What McKinstry did is he decided to rest most of his star players, including the likes of Bayisenge, Irani, the midfielder, and Tuisenge, the captain and the winger. And he gave his reserves a trial. And Morocco, who are fighting for their lives, just outclassed the Rwandans. So what that has revealed to me is while Rwanda have got a very competitive first 11, it looks, Sonny, as if they may not have great depth to their squad. Morocco won 4-1. It could have been 6 or 7-1 by the final whistle. and a really bad day for the Rwandans all around. The rain lashed down, a lot of drenched spectators, and then on top of that you had this gold deluge, but it was coming from the Moroccans and not the Rwandans. The second place in Group A went to Ivory Coast. They finished 4-1 winners over Gabon. The Ivorians only needed a draw. The Gabonese had to win. At one stage it was 1-1, but then the Ivorians took over. And they're a side to watch, Sonny, because after their initial match, which they lost 1-0 to Rwanda, they've had two good wins. They beat Morocco, and now this convincing victory over Gabon. On to Group D, and the winners there were Cameroon. They beat DRC 3-1. And they will be at home in the quarterfinals in Butare, in the south of the country, on Saturday against Ivory Coast. And they're potentially another great match. Two sides very much in form. Cameroon taking advantage of the fact that the Congolese rested a lot of their players, especially those who had yellow cards from previous matches. And Etuba is looking like a very impressive midfielder. He's won three consecutive Man of the Match awards, the only player to do that so far in the competition. And he is deadly from free kicks. He's got a lethal left foot. He knows how to curl that ball either around or over the walls and past goalkeepers. So he's certainly one to watch. The Ivorians very much a team. They don't have the individual stars like Yaya Touré, who plays for the Cup of Nations squad. The Ivorians rely on their teamwork, and if you look at their goal scorers, the goals are coming from various players. So, Sonny, on Saturday in Kigali, Rwanda against DR Congo, and in Butare, it's Cameroon against Ivory Coast. And please don't ask me to forecast the winners of those two matches. It's too hazardous.
All right, David. We won't ask for a weekend forecast. That's David Legg, our African football guru. Taking a quick look at the top goal scorers in Rwanda, Ahmed Akachi of Tunisia and Chizom Chikatara of Nigeria are the joint top scorers with 4 goals each. Akachi could add to his total this weekend, since the Carthage Eagles of Tunisia are taking on the Eagles of Mali Sunday in Kigali. But Chikatara's tournament is over, since the Super Eagles of Nigeria were eliminated on Tuesday by Guinea 1-0. After the quarterfinals this weekend, the remaining matches in Rwanda will take place in the capital, Kigali. The semifinals are scheduled for February 3rd and February 4th, and the third-place match and final for February 7th. Let's take a break now for these Voice of America programming announcements.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting Monday, February 1st, we will begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, select the number 25 to leave us your answer.
Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Voice of America.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Turning to tennis, Britain's Andy Murray reached his 5th Australian Open men's final on Friday when he beat Canada's Milos Raonic in 5 sets. The final score from Melbourne Park, 4-6, 7-5, 6-7, 6-4, and 6-2. Andy Murray has two Grand Slam singles titles on his resume, Wimbledon in 2013 and the U.S. Open in 2012. But he's never lifted the trophy down under in Australia. And the Scotsman now has the daunting task of taking on world number one and defending champion Novak Djokovic of Serbia in the final. Djokovic, bidding for a sixth Australian Open championship, has never lost a title match at Rod Laver Arena in Melbourne. And three of Djokovic's wins in Australia have come in the finals against his old friend, Andy Murray. In Murray's words, talking about Djokovic, he loves playing on this court. We've played a bunch of times here. Hopefully, it can be a different result on Sunday. Andy Murray has had a lot on his mind in Australia, in addition to Novak Djokovic. Murray's wife, Kim, is back in Britain and due to have their first baby next month. And Murray also had some worries about Kim's father, Nigel Sears, who was in Melbourne as coach for Anna Ivanovic and had to be rushed to a hospital during one of her matches. Sears spent a night in the hospital and Murray visited him, and he was cleared by doctors to return home. Meanwhile, as I said on Thursday's Sunny Side of Sports, it's looking like deja vu down under in Australia. The defending champion in women's singles, Serena Williams, is, like Djokovic, only one victory away from another title in Melbourne. Serena will be the favorite when she plays seventh-seeded German Angelique Kerber in the women's final this weekend. If Serena wins her seventh Australian Open singles title, she'll tie the now-retired German Steffi Graf with 22 Grand Slam championships, the most by any player, male or female, in the modern era. And while David Legg didn't want to make a forecast about that football tournament in Rwanda, I'll serve up this prediction about the tennis action in Australia. Look for Novak Djokovic and Serena Williams to repeat as champions this weekend at Melbourne Park. You heard it here first, Sunny Side of Sports fans. I mentioned February 7th as the date of the African Nations Championship football final in Kigali, Rwanda. On that same day, in American-style pro football, the Carolina Panthers will play the Denver Broncos in Super Bowl 50, one of the most watched sporting events here in the United States. The big game will be played in Santa Clara, California. And in advance of the Super Bowl, hundreds of workers have been painting, planting grass, and wiring Levi's Stadium for the contest. The state-of-the-art stadium is where the San Francisco 49ers in the National Football League play their home games. The stadium features solar panels and a green roof with vegetation covering a waterproof membrane. Super Bowl 50 will be broadcast all over the world. And if you want to air some advertisements during the game, well, you better have a good chunk of money in your bank account. The rate for 30 seconds of television advertising during the Super Bowl is approximately $5 million for 30 seconds. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Big money, big money.
Whoa, whoa, whoa,
Sonny. Have a good weekend, VOA listeners. Back to Yahya Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, so how many ads are you taking out for the Super Bowl, Sonny?
I don't quite have that kind of money in my bank account, Kim.
You can listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC. Right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party planning to hold a lavish $800,000 birthday party for President Robert Mugabe next month. And next, an award to motivate young artists in South Sudan. But first, some music. Here is Yvonne Chaka Chaka from South Africa with Motherland. on Chaka Chaka from South Africa with Motherland.
Well, Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party is planning to hold a lavish $800,000 birthday party for President Robert Mugabe next month in the drought-prone Masvingo province of Zimbabwe. Villagers say they are not happy about the cost of Mr. Mugabe's birthday party. They've been surviving by eating wild fruits due to the current dry spell and claim about 5,000 cattle have died as a result of the lack of pastures and state-assisted stock feed. Gondry Maramba of VOA's Zimbabwe program reports.
Baobab fruit porridge, tree roots, and related wild pickings are currently saving the lives of people in Masvingo province, where the current dry spell has reduced fields into dust bowels. The dry spell appears to be fueled by the El Nino weather phenomenon that has brought a lot of heat in the region, widely known for producing top-grade sugarcane, ethanol, and other related products. Although all the dry spell is visible, and government is said to resettle over 20,000 people who were displaced by floods near Tokwe Mkosi Dam 2 years ago, there is a lot happening in Masvingo province, with a population of about 1.5 million, half of them being threatened by the dry spell. Meetings are being held behind closed doors, where some top ZANU-PF officials are planning to throw a birthday party for President Mugabe, who turns 92 on February 21st. This has drawn the ire of local people, who say ZANU-PF leaders are cold-hearted, as they will be holding an event that is said to cost about 800,000. One of the irate local inhabitants is Prosper Tiringindi.
To me, it doesn't make sense because if I look right now, the current situation that we have in Zimbabwe, actually we are facing a series of drought. Actually, I think the president must do something with that money. They must buy maize from outside of the country and feed the Zimbabweans rather than to enjoy any day. Yes, of course, we can celebrate Flamboy and birthday, but actually the citizens are suffering.
Another local villager, Mugove Makonesi, says the lavish birthday is not a new thing, as the president has been doing this for almost 3 decades.
Mugabe is well known the world over for being a very insensitive leader. This is the time that they should be mobilizing resources to save the lives of the people of Zimbabwe, and particularly the people of Masvingo province, who are perennially hunger and drought ravaged. This insensitivity is nothing surprising. But one of the reasons maybe why he's so insensitive it is because there are so many gatekeepers around him. Probably he's being given the wrong impression. Because if my experience of going out in the rural areas is anything to go by, there is terrible, terrible hunger out there. And I find it to be extremely in bad taste for a president to spend that much for a useless function like his. Here is a whole president who is celebrating the twilight of his life at the expense of those young people in the province who are dying of hunger.
Villagers say the ruling party, which has been in power for more than 35 years, should dump the birthday bash and start looking into the needs of all communities. Pilani Moyo, a Mwenezi district villager who is into cattle farming, says President Mugabe and his party should use the funds raised for the birthday party to buy fodder for millions of livestock.
It is very painful. We had asked for assistance from the government to stock our cattle and to buy cattle feed, but till today there is no response. We are very, very sad that our government is using a lot of money for just one day for a bash, for one person to enjoy, whilst our families are suffering and our cattle are dying.
But ZANU-PF birthday party organizing committee member JP Jabun has strongly defended plans for throwing a lavish birthday party for the president, saying Mr. Mugabe deserves to be honored in such a big way. Jabunu, who is the ZANU-PF member of parliament for Begita South, says preparations for the bash are at an advanced stage. This is not going down well with Zimbabwe's opposition parties. Murangano Chanyao, regional chairperson of the Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, led by Morgan Tsvangirai, believes that ZANU-PF has misplaced priorities.
As Masvingo Urban MDCT, we really condemn that bash with the conduct that it deserves. How can they afford to have that bash when over 500,000 people are facing starvation? Rather than holding that bash, it would be rather better to channel those funds to the starving people in Masvingo province.
This is not the first time that people in Zimbabwe have been grumbling over the splashing of huge amounts of money for hosting the president and the first family's birthday gigs. Last year, Zimbabweans were infuriated when at least 3 million was spent for a lavish 50th birthday party for Mr. Mugabe's wife, Grace. Reporting in Masvingo, this is Gandhi Maramba.
A young South Sudanese woman is the winner of a talent search that was held in Juba. 24-year-old singer Sara Sabrino is the first female to win the competition. Judges invited viewers to vote for their favorite performers. As Mugume Davis Ruar Karinji reports from Juba, organizers believe the three-month contest gives a platform to motivate artists to become national stars.
A group of children who are looked after by the children's charity, Confident Children Out of Conflict, entertained the crowd with the song Amazing Grace during the talent search finale. Minutes later, the seven finalists were called to the stage to perform one last song. Sara Sabrino wore the crowd as she performed Vrindrela by South African music legend Brenda Fassie. Sabrino, who holds a master's degree in communications, says she will now concentrate on her music.
It's like a stepping stone for me. So it gives me the ability to go out there. At first I was a bit afraid, but if people vote, because people voted for me, those people believed in me. So it gives me that confidence to go out there.
Sabrino says, though she started singing at the age of 4 in her local church, this was her first time to perform before a large crowd. She was awarded with 15,000 South Sudanese pounds and a motorcycle for winning this edition of Talent Search. Sabrina says she will use her prize money to buy musical instruments. Second run-up, Emmanuel Joseph received a standing ovation after performing Alkiba's Mwana.
For me, I just came here for talent, but if I get, but now I awarded with 5,000. Thanks God for that. Anything I get is enough for me. I think from here I'll go transit to music industry, and I'm sure I'll make my fans happy and happy all of the time.
Music promoter and judge Bol Sultan, also known as Triple X, says Joseph's performance was excellent. He says he was impressed by how Joseph has developed his talent since joining the competition 3 months ago. Bol Sultan says judges are looking for a lot more than a good singer when they select a winner out of the 27 contestants.
Into the vocal, the stage performance, and engaging the audience. And plus that, we also look into the reports of the faculty of the training discipline.
Fans also get to help choose the winner by sending in SMS messages to vote for their favorite singer. Organizers believe the grand finale will inspire many other young South Sudanese to take part in the contest. 20-year-old Nelson Imule is determined to be a contestant next year.
You know, now, because of this, I'm now feeling that South Sudanese, we are now growing in talent. I'm sure next time I will be even among the talent search runner-up.
Besides the prize money, winners are also given recording contracts. The competition is organized by Talent 5 and the South Sudan Artists Association. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to Guinea Dennis Hankins and U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, Mission Director Michelle Godet, along with United Nations World Food Program, or WFP, Country Representative Elizabeth Farr, and Government of Guinea representatives, visited a Food for Peace school meal site in Boké, Guinea, in late January. As part of the U.S. government's effort to support the economic recovery of Guinea in the aftermath of the Ebola virus disease in March 2015, the U.S. government, through USAID, provided $7.1 million as part of its cooperative program with the World Food Program. As a result, WFP made its largest ever purchase of locally produced rice, supporting local agricultural production and providing children with meals in 710 schools across Guinea. Through the program, 1,258 metric tons of locally produced parboiled rice was purchased from four providers in Nzekure, Boké, and Conakry. Local purchases help build agricultural markets for locally produced rice and support long-term food security. Additionally, farmers learn about the tendering process, how to bid for contracts, how to work with development partners, and are able to build relationships with banks in order to access extended credit at favorable rates. The Emergency School Feeding Program works in areas most affected by Ebola, providing daily hot meals to school children and take-home rations of vegetable oil to girls. The goals of the program are twofold: to meet emergency food security needs and to incentivize parents to send their children, especially girls, back to recently reopened schools. The United States is proud to work with Guinea and its international partners to give Guinea school children the food assistance they need to play their part in building a prosperous future for Guinea and the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.